February 28th, 2022. The time is 1:33. With me this afternoon is Senator Stevens. Welcome.
Thank you.
Senator Greg Jackson, welcome. Senator Reback is on his way, and Senator Machicki will not be here today. I wanted to also thank the recording secretary, Kerry, and also Lydia for making this meeting possible to share with the public and making it an official meeting. Today we have four items on the agenda. The first item is Senate Bill 174, which has been introduced by Senator Wilson. He is here with his staff to introduce the bill. It's the first hearing. We will go through the sectional analysis and have invited testimony, and we'll open and close the public testimony on Senate Bill 174. So with that, Senator Wilson, if you'd like to introduce the bill to the committee and also your aide, and have her walk us through the sectional. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Casillo and members of the Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, this is Senator David Wilson, Senator for District D, and with me is my trusty staff, Ms. Jasmine Martin. Senate Bill 174 prohibits schools and workplace from enacting a dress code that restricts someone from wearing their natural hair. No employer student should be prohibited from participating or attending school because they're wearing their natural hair. Senate Bill 174 defines what standards are acceptable for school districts' employees to place on hair, and we have a couple of invited testifiers as well as letters in your packets on why this bill is essential. And I know a question came up in the previous committee about having workplaces and saying what they should or should not do for their employees. This does not allow workplaces to hire or fire folks on just a standard, but they still have to comply with all the normal standards and at-will employees. It doesn't change any of those type of workplace standards, just that they cannot discriminate on someone's basis solely on their style of hair. And with that, I'll turn this over to Ms. Martin for a sectional analysis and to provide the committee with any other additional information.
Thank you. For the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson. So this is just a two-section bill. Section 1 adds a new section to AS-1403. This is our education statutes. This section disallows a school district from adopting a school dress code that prohibits a student from wearing a hairstyle that is commonly historically associated with race, wearing a natural hairstyle regardless of the student's hair texture or type, or that requires a student to permanently or semi-permanently alter their natural hair. This section makes an exception to allow school districts to restrict hairstyles based on health and safety laws. Section 2 is the language is the same as Section 1, except for it adds this new section to AS-2310, which is our labor laws. And again, it's identical except for it deals with the employer-employee relationship rather than the school-school district or student-school district relationship. Thank you. And we have two invited testifiers online. We have Rosalind Weiss and we have Alyssa Quintine to provide short testimony and maybe answer some questions.
Thank you. My committee aide alerted me to the invited testimony. We've been welcomed by Senator Reback. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for walking us through the sectional. Are there any questions from committee members before we move to the invited testimony portion? Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I heard this in education. I think I like that. I like the bill, but I want to make sure that this in no way forces school districts to allow boys to wear those pants with the waist below their butt. That's not a part of this at all, is it?
No pants on the ground. Pants on the ground. Looking like a fool with the pants on the ground. No, sir.
Thank you. I know I'm in trouble with that, but that's a foolish dress code.
Yes.
Senator Reback, do you have a question?
No. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Wilson, I was just curious just how this bill came to be, if there was an issue where a student was asked to alter their hair and it was something that was traditional for them, or if you could just give a backstory on the bill.
I'm sure this is something that I believe 24 states or
14
states. Sorry, I'm thinking about that other wonderful bill of certificate of need. 14 states have already altered this. This is something I think that you'll hear from our invited testifiers that just goes as one of those unspoken things that many folks of color have to just sort of deal with in silence. And policies and dress codes have been established that sort of discriminates on this issue. You'll hear, we've heard from different folks upon this bill, upon having to take their kids home, people who have adopted kids that are in daycare or preschools or in general schools or private schools. This isn't addressed private schools, but I'm just saying those examples of they may not understand of hair, and they'll say, well, you need to straighten their hair. That hair just looks nappy. It looks unkept. It looks unclean. And so this is something that has been endured more as a silence type of issue. There are, like I said, you'll hear from the invited testifiers, I think, that can give more of their real-life examples and testimony on what they've dealt with going through. And I think there's a couple of letters in the packet that also gives some examples. So this is just something that we felt that could be addressed and just felt like this is something, an issue that I could address.
Thank you, Senator Wilson. And on page 1, lines 9 and 10, it basically outlines what the definition of natural hairstyle is. And I'm curious if those definitions were culled from a different state bill, or how you came about that with that list, and if it includes everything.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is, for the record, Senator Wilson again. That piece of language was also amended in Senate Education to include the language from the Colorado piece of legislation to add a little bit more of examples. It's not all. It's not totally inclusive of everything, but just gives an example of.
Thank you very much. Jasmine, did you want to add to that?
For the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson. I think Senator Wilson covered it. That includes is not a limiting term. So includes, and those are examples, but isn't necessarily limited to.
Thank you very much for that clarification. Okay. We'll go ahead and move to the invited testimony portion of the hearing. Rosalind Weiss, calling in from Anchorage. Rosalind, if you could state your name and affiliation for the record and provide your testimony, please.
Okay. Hello, everyone. My name is Rosalind Weiss, W-Y-C-H-E, and I'm here to speak on, of course, Bill SB-174. I've been doing hair since 1980, and I graduated from New Anchorage Beauty School in 1982. I love hair. I love doing hair. And I own a salon and a school. Teaching is my passion and in my blood. My mom did hair, her mom did hair, and my daughters have all done hair professionally. And I truly love it. I have a lot of clients that come in that have adopted little black and brown children and African children. And they are nowhere near capable of doing their hair a lot of times. And they come to my shop and they ask for help. And I think that's pretty awesome because they're unfamiliar with that type of hair. And sometimes I do see adoptive parents that have shaved the children's hair off because it's a totally different texture. And I feel sad for those children that the parents didn't just come ask for help. My children went to school here in Anchorage as well, and experience different situations. My boys would be told cornrows were not the right fit for the team and needed to cut their hair while they were standing next to a young man with a mullet haircut, which I thought was so weird. And my girls were told their hair was not a girly hairstyle if it was in cornrows. I also remember when my daughter went to Chugiak High School, she could not wear her pink bandana, and she had to come home that day, and I had to go get her from school because she didn't take the time to do her hair. She thought she could just throw on a pink bandana and go home. I'm not sure if the legislators have ever heard of a bad hair day, and that's what she was having. So while I was there picking her up, I was speaking with the counselor about the situation, and three young boys walked by with cowboy hats and trench coats. And I looked at the counselor, and I said, that's acceptable? And he said, I don't make the rules and regulations, but your daughter wearing the pink bandana could be gang-related. And I said, okay. Well, my daughter is about 36. She is 36. And the other day, her daughter wore something on her head to school, and the front office told her she could not have that on her head if it was not religious affiliated. And I was like, wow, I didn't realize that it was still so prevalent in today's time, and that was at East High School. I was very upset when it happened to my daughter, so of course I'm upset that it is happening still with my grandchildren, because I feel like it's a double standard. I have so many children and so many grown people that come to my salon that have had to choose between a hairstyle and going to school or a hairstyle and keeping a job. I just feel there should never be a choice in keeping a natural hairstyle or cultural hairstyle and being able to go to school or keep a job. I know you are a cook or a construction worker, those types of jobs. You should have to tie your hair back so it's not a hazard to you or any other people if your hair is long. I'm a 57-year-old Black woman in Anchorage, and sometimes I don't feel like doing my hair. And I'm a hairdresser, and I do it all day long. But I just can't jump in the shower, wet my hair, and it's a good day. I have to take my time and do all kinds of stuff to this hair. I have to put oil in my hair. And when I don't feel like doing it, I have to put on a cap, a scarf, a hat, or something. I have so many different colors of head wraps to go with all my outfits. But the last thing I did want to say, I'm so glad this bill is on the floor. I can't express that enough, because it has been a long journey of me being in high school, my daughter being in high school, and now her daughter being in high school. Just the other day, my daughter teaches at Mountain View, and she had a parent text her and say, "You just don't realize how you made my daughter's day by telling her how pretty she was and how beautiful her hair was," because the little girl hates her hair because it's short and it's extremely curly, and everybody else in her classroom has this long, luxurious hair, and they tease her. So just by my daughter telling her how beautiful she was that day made her feel a lot better, and the parent actually called and told my daughter. And if you have any questions, you guys can definitely ask me, and that's my testimony today, just as a parent, a grandparent, and a young woman living in Anchorage.
Thank you very much for your testimony and sharing those stories with the committee. Are there any questions? Okay. Senator Reback?
Yes, Madam Chair. I think this is a good bill. I can't imagine that somebody would have to permanently or semi-permanently alter themselves and that would be required. For school, one of my questions, I guess, I don't know if there's somebody online, but when it comes to headdress, I don't know if the colors are – I know that there's been concerns related to gang activity in schools. What I don't want to do is hinder the ability for schools to make sure that they're that they're stopping violent activity. And I don't think that's a racial. I know in the Valley we had the issue with the young Mr. Grunwald, terrible events. But maybe there's somebody online to say what the policies are now in terms of headdress and colors. I know that bandanas are commonly used in those activities. So I'm just trying to better understand whether or not there might be some negative effects of those types of things. I just want it helped me better understand that, if you could, please.
For the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson. So, I assume you're referring to school dress codes.
Right.
So every school or school board in their state adopts their own individual dress codes, and I've looked through them, and they're all a little bit different. A lot of them do reference bandanas. Some of them reference specifically blue or red bandanas. I don't know of any gangs that are operating in Alaska that use pink bandanas, you know, so I don't think that this bill goes so far as to say you can't, you know, if there's evidence of some sort of gang operation in your school, you can't prohibit certain colors from being worn, but you can't prohibit a head wrap from being worn. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. That does. That's my concern is that we're not hindering the schools from being able to protect the kids in that way. So thank you very much. That helps me.
Senator Reback, and certainly we can have additional individuals testify if we want someone from the Anchor School District or something like that. That would help clarify some of those issues. But I'll continue on with the invited testimony. Next, we have Alyssa Quintine. Alyssa, if you could state your name for the record and provide your testimony, please.
My name is Alyssa Quintine. I am a community organizer and creative here in Fairbanks, Alaska. Thank you for making the time here to testify, for me to testify on this. I gave a little bit more in-depth my experience with this issue with the Senate Education Committee, and I really wanted to focus more on my experience in the workplace now being a young adult and working and playing in Alaska. But I've told the Senate committee and other people that want to know that I've pretty much had everything that you could have done to your hair happen. I've been harassed, I've been teased, I've had my hair burned, I've had it cut, I've been tied to things from my hair. I've had all the different comments happen and inappropriate questions and people just coming up and yanking on my hair. And this is educators, teachers, you know, other kids going to school. And this is employers and supervisors and coworkers as well. So it is exactly what Senator Wilson has said. It's something that we suffer in silence because there is nothing or nobody for us to go to talk about what happens to us besides ourselves and our other Black friends and maybe our moms. And that was sort of my case. Specifically in the workplace, it's easier for me to say that the only place I have not experienced hair discrimination is the place that I work now. And I think that is just that I work with decent people. There are two places specifically here in the interior that I worked where there were actual policies that were, you know, enforced that banned my hairstyles after, you know, issues started to escalate. And essentially what happened is that it would start with the questions. Alyssa, why do Black people not wash their hair? Of course, Black people wash their hair. Why are you asking me? And you're like, Alyssa, I hear that Black people's hair don't grow. Alyssa, I heard that Bob Marley's hair was filled with bugs. Just really weird things like that, that I would tell them. I'm not having this conversation with you at work. Can you just go research? Can you do something about that? Like, that's not something you asked me. Then it started coming from my supervisors. Then when I would tell them the same thing of, this is not really appropriate, I don't really feel like answering these questions, can you go do some research? I would get pulled into offices. They would try to measure my braids or my twists. They would try and touch. I would always tell them, no, you're not going to do that. Just leave my hair alone. There was, at one of the places they, had written a policy, saying that I couldn't have, that you couldn't have hair longer than 34 inches because they thought that's how long my hair was, which it wasn't. I told them, nice try, but unless corporate comes down and says, I can't wear my hairstyles, I'm going to continue to do it because it does nothing to impact the ability for me to do my job. And usually where I work is in customer service and nonprofit, so really not much to do with that. The other place, HR got involved and written a policy and gave me an ultimatum of either come back with straight hair or don't come back at all. And, you know, as a young person, you're getting out of college, you're just trying to make money so you can survive. It really put me in a situation where, yeah, either I am able to buy groceries and have straight hair or wear my hair the way it naturally comes out of my head and be broke. And luckily my mom has been doing my hair since I was born. So we were able to really figure out what we could do. But that is the experience for a lot of people in, everywhere, but really in Alaska, is that we are being given ultimatums because of people's ignorance and misunderstandings and microaggressions against Black people and people of color. And it is, it's something that we suffer in silence. I wanted really honestly to also address the concerns specifically about school dress codes and about gang activity. And I was on the diversity committee for the Fairbanks North Star Borough School District. I just recently termed off this past year. And that was one of the things that we worked on. And I worked specifically with the school district to look at the dress code and to, to look at how we could better rephrase that, because I'm just going to be frank here. What you wear on your head does not dictate what you do. And the association of the things that we wear on our hair, so our bonnets, our do-rags, our headscarves, our head wraps, has nothing to do with gang activity. What this has to do with is a misunderstanding of gangs in this country and then what that does to our children. What we're doing when we're saying you can't wear do-rags, you can't wear bandanas, is what we are telling children of color, that you are a thug, you are a criminal, and that everybody that wears a do-rag and a bandana is also, gang related. We know that that's not true. We know that that is, it's a stereotype and it's a microaggression. How we better want to phrase that is, let's look at other things that you can wear on your head if you're having a bad day, and let's also educate our administration, our educators, our teachers of, this is what a do-rag is. This is what it does. This is why the student is wearing it. Has nothing to do with gang activity. And so I worked specifically with that district to phrase it in ways that didn't just straight up say, you can't wear a bandana because that means you're in a gang. Because what is the message being sent to kids? If we're really wanting to protect them, then we need to figure out better ways to A, phrase that, and B, still give them options that, take care of their hair. It's not just, what we wear on our head just because. It's sometimes that's how we style our hair. We, when someone's getting waves, you put a do-rag on. When we're trying to lay down our edges, we put bonnets on with front ties so that we can lay them down, because that is how our hair works. And you need something to lay them down. And that being banned in a school means that you really don't understand us, and you don't understand our hygiene. You don't understand how we're, how we're taking care of our hair. So I'm happy to answer questions about that and the work that I did there. And if I have any documents from that, happy to share that as well. But really what I wanted to leave the committee with is that when it comes to dress codes in the workplace, when it comes to how to enforce this and, safety protocols, all of those exist for a reason. And Black people and people of color have never had an issue complying with it. The issue is when employers misunderstand their employees of color, and they make assumptions based off of stereotypes. And from that discern that our existence is hostile, that it is gang related, that it's unprofessional, that it's unmanageable, that it's snappy. And that's where the problem is. And so what this legislation does is at least sets a precedent and protects, our existence from those microaggressions, from that violence, because the way that I exist, I can't control it. The only thing I can do is best present it. And I think the legislature really has to make a choice. What is more important? An employer's discernment of how they think I should exist in this world, or their constituents' ability to exist and be able to have the access to the resources and the activities and the opportunities that everybody else does in this state? Thank you.
Well, Alyssa, thank you very much for your testimony today. It's really disheartening to hear that you went through that experience where, especially with your employer. And I really, again, appreciate you testifying on this bill and really kind of bringing it to life for the committee so that we understand how this bill personally affects Alaskans. And again, I appreciate it. Any questions that the committee has? Senator Rivak?
Yeah, I will just say thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate that. Helps a lot to understand. And I will say that, just to clarify, with Mr. Grunewald, I don't believe it was an issue of color. They weren't minorities or people of color. So I certainly didn't want to send that message. I just want to be clear on that. Your testimony helps a whole lot. Thank you for being here.
Once again, Alyssa, thank you very much. Next, I'm going to go ahead and open public testimony on Senate Bill 174. Is there anyone here in Juneau that wishes to provide public testimony? Okay. Hannah Floor, if you could state your name for the record and provide your testimony.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Hannah Floor. I am from Petersburg, Alaska, and I'm representing myself. And I wanted to testify today as I'm a white woman, the mother to a black preschool age daughter. You know, I don't have the experience of previous testifiers, but I wanted to testify today because I just really want my daughter to have the freedom to wear her hair in whatever way makes her feel good about herself, just like her white classmates do. And I also wanted to speak to the simple utility of protective styles, kind of similar to what Alyssa was saying. You know, early on in motherhood, I didn't really know how to care for my daughter's hair. And I didn't understand how kind of traditional black hairstyles were related to the way that their hair is and the way that their hair needs to be cared for. And I would often spend, you know, upwards of 45 minutes detangling her hair, which resulted in a lot of tears on her part and damaged hair and just a whole bunch of time invested. And so a lot of these hairstyles that could potentially be prohibited are simply useful in the way that they protect hair. And since I've learned to style my daughter's hair in protective hairstyles, it has really dramatically improved our early morning routine and helped our bond, because we don't argue over how much she dislikes getting her hair untangled every morning. It's really helped her feel good about herself and feel proud of how she's presented. And I think that can't really be underestimated. So that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Hannah, for calling in and testifying on Senate Bill 174. Is there anyone else online who wishes to testify? Okay, seeing none, public testimony is now closed. We will be holding this bill for further consideration, and we will let the sponsor know when we plan to bring it back up. So thank you very much, Senator Wilson.
Thank you.
Sound good. Yeah, so they're going to hold when they...
We'll go ahead and take a brief at ease. Back to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, and next on our agenda is Senate Bill 190, introduced by Senator Rob Myers, and it extends the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. And if you could share your bill with us and have your staff walk us through the sectional, that would be appreciated. We have one individual here under an invited testimony, I believe, or actually a few individuals under an invited testimony, and then we'll go ahead and take public testimony. So with that, Senator Myers, welcome to the Labor and Commerce Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for having me, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Robert Myers, Senator for District B, joining my staff, Dawson Mann. Today we're going to be presenting SB 190, the RCA Board Extension. Before my aide presents the brief sectional, I'll go ahead and speak to the sponsor statement quickly. So SB 190 is a relatively short and simple bill. I know, dangerous statement. But it extends the termination date of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, or the RCA, until June 30th of 2030, in accordance with the recommendation of the legislative auditor. The RCA is an independent quasi-judicial regulatory body that was formed by the legislature in 1999 to replace the Alaska Public Utilities Commission. The RCA monitors active certificates for public utilities and pipelines. These certificates cover a broad range of activities, from provisional certificates for small village water and wastewater systems to fully regulated telecommunications, electric, and natural gas monopolies. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd turn it over to my aide to read through the sectional.
Welcome, Dawson. If you could state your name for the record and walk us through the sectional.
Good afternoon, Chair Costello, Vice Chair Reback, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dawson Mann, staff to Senator Myers. and I will be reading the brief sectional for SB 190, Extending the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. Section 1, AS 44.66.010A, 3, page 1, lines 4 through 6. This section extends the termination date for the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, RCA, until June 30th, 2030. Section 2, page 1, line 7. This section establishes an immediate effective date.
Are there any questions for the bill sponsor? Okay, seeing none, looks like you got off easy, but thank you for being here to introduce your bill. Next, I'd like to invite Chris Curtis, who's our legislative auditor, to walk us through the audit related to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Chris Curtis, your state legislative auditor. So the Division of Legislative Audit conducted a sunset audit of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. I believe you all have a copy of the audit in your meeting packets, dated September 2021. So we concluded that RCA operated in an effective manner and served the public's interest by assessing the capabilities of utility and pipeline companies to safely serve the public, by evaluating tariffs and charges made by regulatory agencies, verifying the pass-through charges to consumers from electric and natural gas utilities, and by adjudicating disputes between ratepayers and regulated entities, by providing consumer protective services, and by performing financial reviews of utilities as part of the state's power cost equalization program. We're recommending the legislature extend this commission 8 years. That's the maximum allowed for in the statutes. So quickly go through the results of the audit. If you turn to page 19, you're going to find the results of the survey we sent to 188 individuals that were party to a docket or a tariff from July 2017 through February 2021. We received 59 responses.
Chris, if we could take a brief at ease. To the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, we're hearing Senate Bill 190.
Okay, so the survey questions are summarized in Appendix B. So 49% of survey respondents reported being satisfied or very satisfied with RCA's overall services, while 14% disagreed or strongly disagreed. 67% of survey respondents believe that the commission often or always meets its statutory timelines when carrying out its duties, while 7% stated the commission rarely or never met its statutory timelines. Additionally, 66% of respondents agreed or strongly agreed that the commission effectively communicates when providing services, while 13% of respondents disagreed or strongly disagreed. So in looking at the graphs, you can see that the violet and blue colors are positive, the green is neutral. So with every question, the majority of the respondents viewed RCA in a positive light or in a neutral light. So I just wanted to highlight a few other things in the report. Page 4, if you turn to page 4, we conclude that RCA resolved most of its consumer complaints within 30 days, and there is no statutory timeline for consumer complaints, but that is an internal performance measure for the organization. Exhibit 3 on page 5 summarizes a listing of consumer complaints received by RCA from July 1st, 2020 through February 2021. On page 4, we also conclude that RCA processed tariff filings and dockets within the statutory and regulatory timelines. So we make just one recommendation, and it has to do with their meetings. RCA's regulations require the commission to hold meetings twice a month. In instances where there are no agenda items, RCA management cancels the meetings. During the audit, 25 of 88 scheduled meetings had been canceled, and there were 6 instances where consecutive meetings were canceled. According to RCA management, regulations also allow the commission to modify or waive a requirement of their regulations by their motion. And it is true, we found that there is a regulation that allows RCA to waive a regulatory requirement, but it does require an official motion, and we found that they're canceling the meetings without an official motion. It's reasonable to cancel a meeting when there's no agenda items, but it didn't technically comply with their regulations, so we just encourage them to clarify their regulations. Simple administrative fix, not significant in terms of their extension. Responses to the audit begin on page 23. Both DCCD Commissioner and the Chair of RCA are supportive of the maximum 8-year extension.
Thank you, Ms. Curtis. Did they respond at all officially in writing to you regarding the recommendation?
Yes, Chair Costello. Page 25 is the response from the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. And I believe towards the bottom of that and on the next page, they agree to clarify the regulation.
Thank you, Ms. Curtis. Could you also, just for the sake of the committee, mentioned the number of individuals on the board and how long their seats are and their salary. It's my understanding this is a full-time board. Could you correct me if I'm wrong?
Certainly. Page one of the audit talks about the organization of the board. We don't talk about the compensation, but it is my understanding that they are compensated, and so if the chair is on the phone, they can provide some more information about that. But this is... you can see there is, turn the page to page two. There is five positions that I believe are appointed by the governor, confirmed by the legislature. They're 6-year terms, and they must either be a member of the Alaska Bar Association or have a degree in engineering, finance, economics, accounting, business administration, or public administration from an accredited university.
And Chris, could you mention again how many meetings were canceled? In the period of time that this audit covers?
Certainly. 88 scheduled meetings from July 2017 through, I believe, February of 2021. So that's basically 2 meetings a month per their regulations. And so they do schedule those. They put them on their calendar. And then we found 25 of those were canceled, and 6 instances were consecutive meetings were canceled. Now, they'd said we didn't have any agenda items. That seems fairly reasonable, but technically their regulation says they are required to have them. So maybe clarifying that regulation.
Thank you very much, Chris. Senator Stevens.
Thank you. And thanks, Chris. Could you just sort of tell us what the history has been in renewing? This is an 8-year renewal. That's the maximum. Has that pretty much been the case in the past? Can you tell me that?
Certainly through the chair, Senator Stevens. I believe they did receive either a 6- or 8-year extension in the prior sunset audit. In fact, I can confirm that. But they did go through a phase where they received fairly short extensions. I know that we also have a requirement to review their annual report, audit their annual report every other year. And so we are at the agency quite a bit as far as reviewing their compliance with their statutory and regulatory timelines. In the intro to the findings section, the prior audit was 2013, so it was the prior extension was an 8-year extension.
Thank you. There's a value in the legislature know what's going on, with an 8-year extension, be possible that someone could spend 2 terms in the Senate, or 8 terms in the House, and never deal with RCA. That would be possible, right? So I'm just questioning whether, I mean, I have nothing against the board. I think you're probably doing the right job. I just wonder if 8 years is right, and I'd appreciate any thoughts you can share with us on that. And again, the fact that it could be 2 terms of the Senate and nobody could even hear of the RCA Commission.
Yes, certainly through the chair. As far as the sunset process, which is a legislative oversight process, yes, someone could be there for 4 terms and not have us come before them. I know they do have an annual report. I know it's sent to the legislature. I know usually the biggest interest is whether they're complying with their timelines. There's most interest over the years. Are they getting those decisions out timely? And I know years ago there was a lot of concern, and that's why those timelines got into the statutes, because they wanted to hold them accountable to make sure that they're on a timeline. We have found over the last 2 sunsets, which is quite a bit of time, that they're doing a good job in complying with those. But that hasn't always been the case. So it is definitely a policy call to what level the legislature is comfortable with that extension.
I guess that maybe you could help us, Madam Chair. What would be the disadvantage to RCA? What would be the harm to the RCA if we were to have a shorter period of time? Would there be anything you'd see that would be negatively taken?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, no. It's just dealing with our questions, which I don't believe is that impactful. I think it would. There is really no negative connotation. And from my perspective as the auditor to having a shorter extension, sometimes I recommend that when an organization is simply going through a change in their laws. They may have had a clean audit, but they're having a lot of changes in their organizational structure or their laws that they're administering. So there's a lot of reasons to have a shorter extension. And if legislators are interested to have a closer eye on their operations, a shorter extension is definitely warranted.
And thank you, Madam Chair. So this in no way impacts your job. You still do an annual audit, regardless of whether it's 8 years or 2 years or whatever it might be.
Through the chair, it does impact our audit workload. So if we were to do an audit earlier, we would use more audit resources, and there is a cost to that.
Certainly. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator Stevens. And I know that we've got three commissioners, including the chair, are listening and available for questions. So as they're listening, if we turn to them at some point, please feel free to respond to any questions. Chris, do you think that the infrastructure bill and funding coming from the federal government will at all impact the RCA in terms of, especially I'm thinking the telecommunications? And if you're not the right person to answer that question, again, we've got the chairs on the online and the section manager and also another commissioner.
I would defer to those individuals.
Okay, thank you. All right, well, thank you very much, Chris. I appreciate the work you do to provide us with thorough audits. Bob Pickett is the chair of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. And Bob, thank you for being online and for your patience today. Could you answer any of the questions that you feel are worth answering that are appropriate? My question related to the impact of the infrastructure bill, and then also Senator Stevens' question about the 5 year versus or a shorter extension than 8 years.
Yes, Chair Costello, thank you for the opportunity to be here. Concerning the infrastructure bill.
Could you also state your name and affiliation for the record?
Oh,
thank you.
I apologize, Chair. My name is Bob Pickett. I am the chairman of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. I've been a commissioner since 2008 and chairman for approximately 9 of those years. Concerning your comments and question about the infrastructure bill and potential federal funding, outside of the Alaska Universal Service Fund, we are really not a funding organization. That does not mean that our workload will probably be impacted in some fashion, depending on what form the recipient organization takes for these infrastructure bills. Concerning Senator Stevens, I have been through 3 legislative audits, and one of them in particular that was alluded to back about 2010, it went from a 4-year extension because there were a number of challenges the commission was having at that time, down to a 2-year extension, and it did cause some problems with the agency and the amount of resources it took because we literally had auditors working with this for an extended period of time. I think the 8 years is appropriate. And concerning the comments that many senators and legislators may not have any interaction with the RCA, I can see where that may be true, but I would just suggest in the last couple of years, particularly with the telecommunications deregulation, the commission was very active with providing answers and comments on that. And even more so, in 2014, the legislature directed the commission to evaluate the status of the Rail Belt Electric System and come back in a year later, in 2015, and make recommendations to the legislature as to the appropriate course forward. The commission did that. We came up with 5 findings and 5 recommendations and had a very strenuous reporting regime on that with the impacted utilities and other players Alaska Energy Authority, and we came to the legislature in this January of 2020 with a fulsome report, and that led to the passage of SB 123, which resulted in the establishment of an electric reliability organization. Alaska is not under the jurisdiction of the FERC or the NERC, and so we essentially had no enforceable reliability standards, including cybersecurity and physical security. So we'd like to thank the legislature for their assistance in getting that off the ground. And as the regulations go into effect on March the 11th, we'll continue to report back to you on the status of that. We also work closely with the Alaska Energy Authority on the administration of the Power Cost Equalization Program and look forward to making positive changes in the administration of that program. With that, I will be open to any other comments or questions any of the senators may have.
Bob, I appreciate you taking time to answer those questions. And I did have a question earlier just about the salary and then the fact that you're a full-time versus a voluntary or part-time board, as we see so much of in this committee. Could you just respond to that?
I would say it is a more than full-time job, quite frankly. In terms of the salary, are you looking for a specific number? There's a range, and I'm not comfortable speaking for other commissioners because there are merit-based increases that do happen over time.
Sure, if you're not comfortable sharing that, that's fine. We could look it up, I guess, later.
Well, I'm okay with my own salary. I make roughly $153,000 on an annual basis.
Thank you.
And there may be...
Thank you, Bob. I knew it was significantly higher than a legislator, and I do appreciate the full-time commitment to your work there. And I am actually aware that you are full-time. I just thought that it would be good for the public to know that this is not a part-time board or commission, that you're full-time and your docket is pretty significant, and oftentimes your reading is also voluminous. So I appreciate that. And you spend a lot of time looking at each of your cases that you have. In fact, now that I'm talking about that, could you describe some of the work that you do and how much time the commission spends looking at each case?
It varies. I mean, probably the two largest dockets that we've had in the past couple of years, and ironically it was during the peak of COVID, were the transfer of British Petroleum's assets to Harvest, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and several North Slope pipelines. And that was a very lengthy, complicated transfer of that certificate. Equally complicated was Chugach Electric's acquisition of Municipal Light and Power's assets, including the share of the Beluga River gas field. And it's very unusual for an electric utility to actually be a majority owner of a gas field. And so each of those took well in excess of a year, including lots of very analytical, statistical, and just a lot of research and argument, quite frankly, even with the commissioners to try to decide the right course of action. The Electric Reliability Organization development has been a 7-year process, and to develop the regulations in a truncated 1-year period was a very great challenge for the commission. And implementation of that and getting the Electric Reliability Organization up and running will also present challenges for the commission going forward this next year.
Thank you very much, Bob. And it's my understanding that you're located in Anchorage. And are all of the members also in Anchorage, or do you have members that serve that are in other parts of the state?
I actually live in the Matsu Valley, and I drive into Anchorage, and I have the whole time. We've got a Commissioner Kerber, who is based in Fairbanks, and I strongly supported that. I think it's helpful to have candidates that are living in other parts of the state to bring those perspectives into it. And the other three commissioners do live in Anchorage.
Okay. Thank you very much, Bob. I appreciate you being here today. Next, online, we have Kristen Schubert, who's the Commissioner Section Manager for the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. Kristen, did you want to answer any of the questions that you've heard?
This is Kristen Schubert for the record. No, Madam Chair, I don't have anything else to say unless you have any questions specific toward me.
I don't see any questions. Thank you for being online. And also we have Keith Kerber, who's a commissioner out of Fairbanks for the RCA. Keith, did you want to respond to any of the questions that you heard today?
Madam Chair and esteemed members of the committee, ma'am, I have nothing else to add. I believe Chair Pickett has very adequately addressed the questions by yourself and also Senator Stevens. And as today is my 1 year anniversary of being on the commission, I'd have to say that this job is not boring. This has been one of the fastest years of my life. The workload is fairly demanding, but it is more than able to be accomplished by us because we have an outstanding staff who are all hardworking and keyed in on this idea of performing the responsibility of economic regulation of public utilities. And as Commissioner and Chair Pickett just stated, current events suggest that as the development of the ERO begins here in just a matter of days, as it has been ongoing in a parallel fashion with us as the regulation docket proceeded, that it will be very interesting to see how they come about, how they work to develop reliability standards, and also ensure security of the grid. I hope that answered your question, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Keith. Are there further questions? Okay, seeing none, I really appreciate you all being available today for the committee. Next, I'm going to open public testimony on Senate Bill 190. Is there anyone in the room or online that wishes to testify? Okay, seeing none, I will now close public testimony. We will hold this bill for further consideration. And again, I want to thank all of the members who are online, the commissioners who are online for today's hearing, and also the bill sponsor for being here. Thank you, Senator Myers. Next, we have Senate Bill 193. This is a bill to extend the Board of Chiropractic Examiners. And staff to Senator Michicki are here to introduce the bill. Conrad Jackson, Chief of Staff to the Senate President, and Madison Govan, who's also here. If you could introduce yourself to the committee and then provide your testimony, please.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. For the record, Conrad Jackson, staff to Senator Michicki.
And for the record, Madison Govan, staff to Senate President Michicki.
First, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I want to extend Senator Michicki's apologies. He's been delayed in getting back to Juneau and is unable to make it, so he's asked us to cover for him today. The bill before the committee, Senate Bill 193, extends the Board of of chiropractic examiners, and at the recommendation of the legislative audit, is for 5 years. This obviously, as you've just heard with the RCA extension bill, is that opportunity that the legislature has to review how boards are operating, make sure they are operating in their statutory capacity and in the public interest. And with that, Madam Chair, I will turn things over to Madison for a little more in-depth on the bill.
Welcome, Madison.
Thank you. Again, for the record, Madison Govan, staff to Senate President Michicki. Senate Bill 193 extends the termination date of the Chiropractic Examiners Board, which is set to sunset on June 30th of this year. After the legislative audit was conducted, they concluded that it would be in the state's best interest to extend this board for an additional 5 years, making the new sunset date June 30th, 2027. In accordance with the provisions of Title 24 and Title 44, a legislative audit reviewed the activities of the Chiropractic Examiners Board and determined the board served the public's interest by conducting meetings in accordance with state laws, amending certain regulations to improve the chiropractic profession, and effectively licensing and regulating chiropractic positions. I urge your support of this bill to extend the sunset date of the Chiropractic Examiners Board. Thank you for your time. We will stand by for any questions.
Thank you very much. Madison, is this the full extension that is allowable under law?
No, ma'am. Through the chair. No, I do not believe it is. No.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much. I don't see any questions from committee members. Next, we will have Chris Curtis, the legislative auditor, present the audit findings to the committee.
Good afternoon. For the record, Chris Curtis, legislative auditor. I believe you have a copy of this audit in your meeting packets as well. It's dated June of 2021. So overall, we found this board served the public's interest by conducting their meetings in accordance with state law, by amending certain regulations to improve the chiropractic profession, and by effectively licensing and regulating chiropractic physicians. Additionally, the audit found that one board member did not meet the statutory requirements for appointments, and additional resources were needed to investigate cases in a timely manner. So we are recommending a five-year extension that is 3 years less than the eight-year maximum allowed for in statute. The reduced extension is due to an issue we identified during the audit that may impact the board's ability to protect the public. The report does not include the details of this issue to preserve the confidentiality of an ongoing investigation. We made two recommendations. Oh, I want to walk you through the standard information in the report. Licensing information is on page 5. So as of January 2021, there were 306 active licenses and permits for this board. If you turn to page 6, you will see the schedule of revenues and expenditures. The board alternated between a surplus and a deficit. The Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing Management regarded the deficits as within a reasonable range, and so they did not recommend a fee increase. And you will see the fees listed on page 7. We do make two recommendations. They begin on page 9. First, we recommend to the governor that he make appointments in accordance with statutory requirements. We found the public board member was a licensed EMT, and the public member is prohibited by statute from having a direct financial interest in the healthcare field. So technically, an EMT has a financial interest. The second recommendation is on page 10. We recommend DCBPL's director allocate sufficient resources to ensure cases are investigated in a timely manner. So there were 11 cases during the audit period that were open for over 180 days. We reviewed all of them. We found 7 of them related to the same chiropractor, and those 7 had been combined into one case. And for that combined case, we found 4 periods of inactivity. And the periods range from 55 days to 208 days. According to DCBPL investigative staff, the inactivity was the result of competing priorities and insufficient resources. Management's response to the audit begins on page 21. The commissioner of DCCED states that the department has now hired 2 additional investigative positions, and she believes that that will increase the quality and the timeliness of the investigations. The governor's response is on page 23. He agrees with the recommendation and stated that the board member who did not comply with statutes has been removed. And then the board chair response is on page 25. The board chair does not agree with the recommended extension of only 5 years. He believes that the board was being unfairly penalized for the findings that we have in the report, and that those are outside of the board's purview, and so he is asking for a maximum 8-year extension.
Thank you, Chris. And I find it interesting that the description is that the board is penalized. Do you want to comment on that? I mean, every board is reviewed via audit and by the legislature. It's to protect the public. So did you want to comment on that?
Certainly. And this is last year or two, I've seen this perception by auditees that it's a negative process, that the legislative oversight sunset is, and the extension, if they receive an extension recommendation for less than 8 years, that it's somehow punitive in nature. We do try to explain that this is simply an oversight mechanism, and there's so many things that can go into our recommendation of the term of extension. It's a trigger for us to come back in and review the state of the board. So, like I said earlier, that could be simply because there's a lot of changes to the laws or the board's been under some type of reorganization, say they got a new task, and that might impact the public. We want to come in earlier to take a look at it. So it's simply an oversight, legislative oversight mechanism.
Thank you. And Chris, so with the 7 cases involving the same chiropractor and then the days of inactivity ranging of up to 208 days, 4 periods of inactivity, are there any statutes that oversee the timeliness of investigations that the department oversees?
Through the chair, no, there is no statutes like a timeline, like RCA has the statutory timelines and regulation statute. No. The division has their own policies that do try to encourage timely investigations. We found over the past several years they're really under a resource crunch, and we found continual problems in their investigative process over the last several years.
Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have one question. The board member that didn't meet the qualifications and was removed, how long had that member served on the board?
I don't know that. I wish I knew that. Senator Costello, can I ask my auditor responsible for that, whether we know that?
Absolutely. We'll take a brief at ease. Thank you, and welcome back to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. The legislative auditor indicated in that at ease that Senator Gray Jackson's question about the board member who was actually ineligible, will get more information about that individual. So,
thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Chris, what about the history of the board and the audits? Could you just review that for the committee? Were there any times where the 8 years was not recommended?
Through the chair, I don't have that. The last time we did the audit was 2013, so this board did receive an 8-year extension the last time we conducted the sunset.
Thank you very much. Okay. Next, we have Brian Larson, who's the chair of the Board of Chiropractic Examiners, here for invited testimony. Brian, if you could state your name and affiliation again for the record and provide your testimony.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Dr. Brian Larson. I'm in Soldotna, Alaska. I'm a chiropractic physician, specialized in sports injuries. I am currently serving as my second term as a member of the Alaska Board of Chiropractic Examiners and my second 2-year term appointed by my colleagues on this board as the chair of the board. So I'm available to answer your questions. I believe I can probably give you some additional help and information on that board member that was that had been appointed to the board and put forward for legislative approval, if you would like that.
That would be great, Brian. Thank you very much if you could do that.
Okay. The public member of the board that had been approved by the by chair, or what is it, boards and office of boards and chairs, no, office of boards and commissions, there we go, and appointed by the governor, was, I believe, began the process of legislative approval when it was discovered that he indeed was full-time, was employed full-time in the healthcare industry, at which time he was asked to, and he very appropriately and immediately resigned his commission to maintain or make sure that was appropriate. Apparently, as in talking with the audit committee, is that this was the second time this had happened in 2 consecutive 8-year periods of sunset for this board. And again, is in regard to the investigations, and again, this was the second time in 8 years that there had been, for various reasons, delays that investigations had not completed their work. What I find interesting is, and there was a remark that the board felt that this was punitive in nature, it's hard not to see that that this is some sort of recourse against the board, specifically from the standpoint of is the board has been found appropriate in all actions except these two matters, and yet the board has absolutely no oversight or no ability to influence either of these two processes in any way. The board does not get to evaluate the applications of people for the board. And I can't help but think that had this application for a new board member, the public board member, if that someone would not have read through and said he's employed full time in healthcare, he's not eligible to be the public member of the board, that this never would have gone through the whole course and all the way to the legislature, utilizing your time for things that were not required. Again, is the board has no say whatsoever in the investigative process. In fact, we're not even told who the individuals that the chiropractors that may be under investigation are. And so therefore we have no push pull or any way to direct how the appropriateness or speed of any type of investigation work. And yet the board again is being recommended that the review or that the sunset committee or sunset period be reduced for something the board has no ability to determine. And that's been the basically is the long and short of my questioning shortening the next approval period to 5 years.
Well, thank you very much, Brian, for that explanation. And I do hear what you're saying. And I guess I just want to add, you know, for your edification, is that really I see the audit of the board's activities as an audit of not the board itself, but the activities that you conduct on behalf of the Alaskans that are served by the profession itself. And so I think that while, you know, your points are, you know, well taken, I do believe that the job of the legislative oversight is really a broader net. And it includes actually the Division of Corporations, Businesses, and Professional Licensing. And we'll have Sarah Chambers up next to talk about some of the challenges with the investigation. So I just want to pass that on, that I do appreciate all the work that you do. I've in my job as Chair of Labor and Commerce, I've actually sat in and visited many boards that oversee professions. And I can tell you, I know that you work very hard and diligent and, you know, on behalf of your colleagues, and that what you're doing really is above and beyond the practice that you personally have. So I just want to add that, you know, for the record, that I really see it as on behalf of the public, we're looking in on the whole entire profession and just checking in. And this is our opportunity, you know, to talk about some of your successes and also the challenges that you face. So are there any questions for Mr. Larson? Okay, seeing none. Thank you. Thank you again for your patience and for being here today. And next we'll have Sarah Chambers come forward and talk to us about the findings of the audit and a deeper dive on the investigative process.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, this is Sarah Chambers. I'm the Director of the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. And I appreciate the opportunity to meet with you on this audit, and want to also appreciate your staff for bringing me water. Thank you. And offer appreciation for the audit staff as well as the board. I think that we are going through, as Madam Chair indicated, going through a necessary process to make sure that all components are working together, that we're all supporting the efforts of the legislature and the board. So appreciate the audit. We always learn something new, or we get reminded of things that we need to continue to make progress on. And this board works extremely hard. So I'm happy to talk about the investigative process and the findings unless you have specific questions, Madam Chair.
I'll look to the will of the committee. Senator Stevens.
Madam Chair, I don't have any questions on the Board of Veterinarians. I'm chiropractic, I'm sorry. I have no questions about that, but I would like to talk to you at a later date about the earlier board that we were talking about.
The RCA.
The big one, the RCA. Yeah. So that's, can we talk about that at some point, Madam Chair?
Absolutely.
Well, Madam Chair, through the chair, I'm happy to talk about the RCA, but I really don't have anything to do with the RCA professionally. That might be something with Chair Pickett or Commissioner Sandy to bring up. That's outside my division.
It doesn't come through your division at all. Huh?
Thank goodness, no.
Thank you.
Sarah, I do have a few questions. So with all the boards that come through this committee, over the years, we've kind of gone back and forth about how to deal with investigations. There have been legislation to, make sure that's funded through the general fund and doesn't affect the board's fees. Could you talk about this board in particular, how their fees have been over the years, and if this case is expected to increase the fees of the board?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. That's an excellent topic and a really big topic. And I know that I have our fee history in here. So for everyone's benefit, for the committee's benefit, professional licensing investigations and administration and all of the things that the audit looked at are all covered through licensing fees predominantly. In FY21 and FY22 and again in FY23, we have asked for and received and hope to receive a small amount of general fund to help during this sort of COVID season to help prevent us or keep us from having to increase fees where that may be warranted for boards. So we appreciate that infusion of general fund and are looking to some of the solutions, Madam Chair, that you mentioned, possibly to come back through the legislature on how can we in Alaska with our interesting economy of scale help to keep a robust and well-resourced investigative and administrative process going forward in our division without asking our healthcare providers and others to completely shoulder those responsibilities. It is a model that many states use, but many states have 250,000 nurses, or they have 100,000 chiropractors, or we have 300, or we have 25,000 nurses. And so we have all of the same infrastructure. We have to do all the investigation, issue licenses quickly, make sure that our providers meet all of the legal standards on a scale that is much smaller in funding than other states. Now, usually that works well. Usually we have, for all practical purposes, it works well, except in the cases where we have a complex investigation, where we have a denial of licensure, where licensees or applicants have due process to appeal, and we can see those cases upwards of $100,000. And our licensees have to pay. There's 300 chiropractors have to pay for that. And the case that's in question right now is in litigation, so I'm not able to, as Ms. Curtis mentioned, not able to go into details, but any case that goes into litigation that is being appealed is going to cost money that our chiropractors or others have to pay. So we are trying to keep their budget. It's not a zero-sum budget, but we're trying to keep enough money to sort of float the average bump in investigation or bump in appeal costs, because we know it's a cost of doing business, and that's the way that legislation, that statute frames this process right now. But when we have a dramatic case, and we have had several dramatic cases in this profession in particular, but in many other professions, those costs are going to keep going up. And they are not really, the big cost is not with our office. As you can see, we have we are continuing to add investigators because our workload is increasing in number and complexity. But those costs are usually just the cost of paying attorneys. And the Office of Administrative Hearings, which is outside of our control. So, Madam Chair, I hope that answered your question, but I'm happy to follow up.
Thank you, Sarah. And so how many investigators did you assign to this board when you first – I mean, what was the process? I mean, there was one individual who had multiple complaints, and then you brought it all into one case. At that point, can you explain to the committee why there may be a delay of 200 and some days just kind of walk us through that.
Sure, thank you. So we have a pool of investigators who work for me, for the division. And we have, and I'm not going to get these numbers exactly right because I didn't refresh my mind on our org chart, but we have approximately 17 investigators for our 43 professional licensing programs. And that 17 multiple investigators are investigators are always assigned according to where the need is. And we prioritize life, health, and safety. So we're really trying to work on where Alaskans may be at risk versus smaller cases or cases that don't pose an immediate risk where there may be a, it's like a paperwork type of violation, a continuing education violation, a business licensing violation that doesn't rise to the level of an Alaskan who could actually be, you know, harmed by this practitioner. So we're always trying to be fluid and using our resources wisely. And we also look at ensuring that our investigators are working on cases where they have knowledge. So healthcare investigators are often usually not working on healthcare cases, and real estate investigators, construction, architecture are working on the areas where they have that very different set of knowledge. So in this situation, our investigator was working not only on chiropractic, but on dental and nursing. So we have a fraction of an investigator working on chiropractic. And where other cases with chiropractic, as well as other cases in nursing and dental, were more pressing, we had actual complaints that had been filed. We had evidence that was able to be collected. Those are all matters that were sort of ahead in the queue than this one. And our attorney on this one had given us some advice that led our investigators to interpret that as substantiating it being lower on the priority list. So that case is moving forward now, but it was at the time of the audit not the highest priority for our team.
Thank you. And I do recognize that in an ongoing investigation, it's really confidential and you really aren't able to give us any information. But at what point does the legislature get that information, and will we ever?
Yes, Madam Chair, we always make public the discipline. If there is discipline, if there's a consent agreement, for example, if the licensee makes an agreement that says that they agree to certain terms and the board agrees to certain terms, that is a public document that often includes discipline. If the licensee's license is conditioned, if it's revoked, if it's put on, the person is put on probation, those are all public documents, and those are posted on our website. So once it's complete and the board rules or the appellate court rules, then that becomes a public document.
Thank you. And then unrelated to this, obviously, because I know nothing about the case. So what happens when the complaint you believe is criminal in nature? I mean, does then it go to law enforcement, or can you tell us what happens in that case?
Yes, thank you. When there is a potential criminal element as well as a civil element, we are a civil agency and not a law enforcement agency, then we work. We have a very close relationship with various federal agencies, everyone from the DEA, the FBI, of course, state and local criminal authorities, that we have found that it is more effective and efficient for us to sort of hand over our knowledge and information to the criminal unit, have them move forward because they are often moving faster, better resources. They move forward with their element and their piece, and then they come back and we take licensing action based on the criminal finding. It keeps us from having to do duplicate work. And in often cases, oftentimes the coordination is really difficult and we can step on each other's toes and harm each other's investigations if one of us isn't the lead agency. So that actually was a process that we worked out after a previous legislative audit where it was brought to our attention that this could be done better. We worked on it and have seen that to be helpful. I think in the matter, often with legislative audits, an area where we have needed to improve and our investigators have worked diligently to improve, which we hope will be borne out in future audits, is that we're doing a better job of noting that progression in our case management files. One of the areas in this audit, as well as previous audits that the committee may have heard before and may hear again for that period, is that our investigators for a time would hand over the case to another agency and then not document every 30 days, not document that this was still handed over and that we haven't forgotten about it. It's just being worked by another agency. And so that's something that as a result of legislative audits, we're getting a lot better at keeping our case management notes open. So when that criminal investigation is done, we can jump on it, get together with the board, and take any licensing action that may be necessary.
Senator Stevens?
Maybe you already told me this, but I may have missed it. Where did we determine that a board member was inappropriately appointed to the board because he and maybe shouldn't have been because of an EMT? Did it come through your office or through the audit? Where was that discovered?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens. That came out, to my understanding, that came out through the audit, that was a finding. It's part of the auditor's criteria. And what, as soon as it was brought to the governor's office attention, that was handled appropriately. And as Dr. Larson, Chairman Larson, said, that the board member understood and willingly resigned. Our agency doesn't have anything to do with board appointments and who's seated and the criteria. We usually find out after the appointment is made.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. Thank you, Sarah. Are there further questions for Sarah Chambers? Okay, seeing none, I'm going to actually open public testimony on Senate Bill 193. And is there anyone here in Juneau who wishes to testify or anyone online? Okay, seeing none, public testimony is closed on Senate Bill 93. Senator Rivak, did you have a comment?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I had no idea about the intricacies of this board, but it sounds like the board is backbreaking work. Board members certainly require a backbone. It sounds like in many ways some of their backs are against the wall. We certainly don't want to send them backwards. We also certainly don't want to turn our backs on them, and so I appreciate the bill sponsor bringing this sunset extension forward. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, I certainly appreciate some levity. We do deal with a lot of serious issues here. Occasionally comments like that are appreciated, but we will be holding this bill for further consideration. And if any of the members have any questions for those who testified or Sarah Chambers or our state or legislative auditor, please run them through my committee and we will get the answers to you. And we will be holding this bill for further consideration. And we'll take a brief at ease. Senate Labor and Commerce Committee is called back to order. There was one item on the agenda, Senate Bill 185, introduced by Senator Machicki, which dealt with eliminating the minimum wage exemption. We had a number of individuals here in the room and online waiting to testify on that. I do apologize that we have run out of time today. We will hear that bill at a further meeting. That concludes this afternoon's meeting. Our next meeting is going to be Wednesday, March 2nd at 9 a.m. This is a new time for the committee. We are adding this meeting to deal with the governor's appointees to boards and commissions. There will also be a 1:30 meeting that same day, March 2nd, which will feature a presentation on workforce development and infrastructure development. And with that, we are adjourned at 2:59.